Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. I am Bob Enyart. Welcome to another edition of Real Science Friday with Fred Williams, my co-host in studio.
Bob, thanks for having me back.
Fred is the webmaster for Creation Research Society. What a great group of scientists and laymen who are members. Fred, last week we were talking about the fall issue 2007 of the Creation Research Society Quarterly. We talked all about the flat earth, the false accusations made against Christians, when really a lot of the flat earth was just invented, basically. And the whole thing about the sun orbiting the earth came from Aristotle, not from the Bible. And so now I'd like to finish that discussion, if that's right with you. There were two books written by an author, Larry Witham. Who is Larry Witham?
He's a Washington Times reporter.
That's right. Reporter for the Washington Times, and he interviewed a couple hundred scientists, philosophers, and so on about creation and evolution. And he concluded his first book on the topic, Where Darwin Meets the Bible, with this. He said, first of all, that the debate has changed from defending the Bible to making scientists defend the holes in evolution theory. Have you noticed that in your life? Have you seen that shift?
I would say so. You know, you'll still get evolutionists who you'll start debating them on some scientific topic, and they'll be losing the argument, so they'll change the topic to the Bible and say,
they're
well, what
desperate.
About, yeah, well, you know, the Bible says that animals chew their cud, pie's wrong in the Bible, all these silly things that we have answers for,
right.
But the point is they're changing the topic because they can't defend their theory.
They want to change the topic. They don't want, typically, to debate the scientific merits of evolution.
Because evolution in itself is really a religion once you get down to it, once you cut through all the illusion that they use to prop up their arguments. And so once this illusion starts to get exposed, that's when they attack the Bible. So I think we have made a lot of progress in getting them to focus on the scientific part, on the holes in the theory. And that's where the intelligent design movement has been really good, because it's kind of taken away that red herring that they use to go to attack the Bible.
Mm. So the creation science movement has made significant inroads into the thinking of people about the overwhelming evidence for God, our creator. All you have to do is open your eyes. And if you don't have eyes, all you have to do is think. And there is the evidence. But then marshaling the observations of science to show how the book of Genesis is completely reliable, and how it's overwhelmingly clear that God created us. That's exciting.
Right. His invisible attributes are clearly seen, as it says in Romans 1.
The book of Romans, New Testament. So we have a shift in the battlefield. And now the evolutionists are more on the defensive, and they are. That's why they're firing scientists right and left. If the scientist says, hey, I doubt Darwin's theory, that's it. They're fired.
Yeah, and they're developing pamphlets to give to their teachers, because their teachers are complaining, hey, you know, my student brings up this point about...
My students are more well-informed
than
I am.
They are, and I can't answer their objections.
Right.
And so they're trying to come up with answers to give these students.
Yeah.
And, of course, they don't really have good answers. All they can work off of are illusions. They're like magicians. And unfortunately, it'll fool a lot of people. Mm. But as creationists, we're trying to get the information out so that, you know, students can have their baloney detector on and know when there's baloney involved, and they can see through the illusions. Mm-hmm. You know, we've talked about all kinds here on the show.
So the battle is shifting, and the evolutionists are, I think, at a significant level on more of a defensive than they have been on in the last 100 years. And I mentioned Brian Rohrbaugh on the last program and never completed the point that Ben Stein has this movie coming out in the spring, Expelled, No Intelligence Allowed, in the theaters nationwide. And a film crew went to Brian Rohrbaugh's home to interview him for this movie about intelligent design and anti-Darwinism. And why would they do that? You know, Brian's son, Danny, was murdered at Columbine. But they interviewed Brian because the murderers in that crime and in others used Darwinism as their justification. And in the basement videos that were made before that crime, the murderers said that survival of the fittest, they had a duty through Darwinism to destroy the weaker organisms that didn't deserve to live.
Yeah, and even in their diaries, Harris wrote that him and Klebel are going to kick up natural selection if you Nazis come mm-hmm. April. Mm-hmm. They were big into evolution. In fact, Harris, when they found him dead, had a T-shirt that said natural selection on it.
That's
of course,
right.
That was buried in the back of the report on this in the Denver Post. But what it really does, it gets to the root cause of the problem of why kids are killing other kids. When we educate our kids that you're just evolved animals, why are we surprised when they behave like
when
animals?
Animals kill other animals.
And yet people are here trying to blame it on guns and all these other reasons in psychology.
Right.
No, it's because we're teaching them that they're animals and what's going to happen when you do that.
So Denver Public Schools want to give birth control to kids? And they're surprised when kids act like animals. So your daughter, you send her to a public school, it doesn't matter, Denver or wherever, and when she acts like an animal, don't be surprised because you sent her to a school where they will teach her she is an animal. And then your daughter, who you love, you think is precious, will act like an animal. The boys in her class will use her, and she will go along with it, and you've set her up for that.
Yep, and studies show that 70 to 90% of our kids leave the Christian faith after they go to a public school. So by the time they're out of high school, the number, of course, increases as they go to college.
Wow, so I'm a big advocate of homeschooling. Christian homeschooling is the best. And Christian schools, don't assume a Christian school is good because some are liberal.
Some will
even teach evolution.
That's right.
And all of the charter schools in Colorado and around the country, they're all godless. They are godless. And so that's a problem. But there are some Christian schools that teach young earth creationism, that abortion is wrong, homosexuality is wrong. And so you got to be careful.
There are some good schools that stand on the foundation of the Bible. In fact, Maranatha Christian Center is one.
In Arvada.
Highly recommending our kids go to because they stand on Genesis. They don't compromise. Because when you compromise, Bob, it becomes a slippery slope. Once you compromise on the first book of the Bible, why not down the road then compromise on homosexuality, like you said, abortion? Even believing in the resurrection. You get churches now that deny the resurrection and still claim to be Christian. It's amazing.
They got a 5-ton boulder there at the front of the school, and they had etched into the boulder, "In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth." That's really cool
that's
at Maranatha
really neat. Yes.
In Arvada. Okay, so this Larry Witham, his book, he concludes in this way. He talks about Darwinism. After interviewing 200 prominent players in the evolution creation debate. And he says that materialism among scientists, biological scientists, he said materialism is not really in crisis in biology. Most of the writers and speakers and scientists are materialists. He said, but Darwinism is in crisis. Darwinism is in crisis because mutations, that's when things break down, and natural selection, these things cannot explain a million extraordinary species that we have. There is an intelligent designer.
That's right. Mistakes in the DNA and then culled by some kind of blind selection process, there's no way can account for all the vast complexities that we have, you know, that we see in the world. And it's funny you mentioned, you know, this theory being in crisis. It reminds me of Michael Denton was a well-known evolutionist who wrote a book called Evolution, A Theory in Crisis. Of course, by him doing that, he's highly criticized now. In fact, I was just in a debate on my forum about cytochrome C. They try to use cytochrome C to argue that, hey, you got this protein that is, you can look at it and build a tree of evolution. Well, what I did on the forum, Bob, was I posted the cytochrome C sequence for all these different animals, but I didn't give the names of the animals. I just put animal one, animal two, animal three.
Fred, this is going to be brilliant. Now, wait, let the audience know, when you said on a forum, you're talking about evolutionfairytale.com.
Evolutionfairytale.com, and you can go, and it's a pinned topic called cytochrome C something.
That's your website.
Yes.
So cytochrome C, a protein.
Yes.
And they appear in different animals.
They appear in almost all different animals, and so evolutionists use it because chimps and humans happen to have the same exact sequence in cytochrome C. So they love it for that reason.
Yeah.
But of course, there's many sequences that we're not similar on, but they love it because of that. And then they extrapolated from that these other species, these other organisms all can form a nice tree that shows
evolved
evolution, because you'll have more changes in cytochrome C in, say, like wheat. Wow, that's a shock, isn't it, Bob? That wheat would have a different sequence you know, radically different than humans and chimps.
Right.
Well, anyway, so I published on my website a sequence, and it shows all the different letters in the DNA, mm-hmm. you know, and so I'm not going to get into the technical part because I don't want people driving to have their heads at the steering wheel.
Right,
you know.
Right.
But anyways, so I had like, I think 30 animals, animal one down to animal 30, and I gave the sequence. So I'm like, okay, now, since you don't know what the animals are, why don't you go ahead and construct your evolutionary tree? So the first evolutionist that took a crack at it, you know, said that, okay, this animal's related to this one, and it's more of a distant relationship with this, with animal 32 and animal,
et
cetera. And so when it was all said and done, I posted what the actual animals were.
Right.
And
this
he got
so
five
funny.
Right, seven wrong, and then 10 were like, you know, they were pretty much wrong. He only got five right. And the five he got right, Bob, were the same ones creationists would have deduced. For example, the fact that a horse is related to a zebra, is that a shock to us that the cytochrome C would be the same?
No.
But he would have like these distant relationships that weren't really distant. It was just all over the map. Mm-hmm. Well, how this gets back to Michael Denton's book on evolution of theory and crisis, he mentioned cytochrome C and how it's actually evidence against evolution, because all it does is show that animals are, there are groups of animals grouped together, but there's no in-betweens, there's no intermediates, there's no tree of life of evolution. It shows what we creationists call the creationist orchard, where certain kinds of animals that we know are of the same kind, like the coyote and the dog, are going to have the same cytochrome C sequence.
Right.
Now, there's some animal, and again, just because the chimps and the humans have one, that doesn't mean they're the same. You're going to have some exceptions. Mm. That's why the evolutionists love it. But it's an illusion when they say that cytochrome C is evidence of evolution and that you can get a tree of life. Because when I did an actual test on the internet, they failed miserably. Of course, they tried to spin it and said, well, distant really could be more recent ancestor. And they changed the meaning of the word recent and distant. You know, they do all these games that they play. But evolution is definitely a theory in crisis. Mm-hmm. And that's just one example that happened to pop into mind.
Mm-hmm. And you know what? With natural selection, as though selection could cause these tiny changes to gradually accumulate and you have new functions arise like echolocation in bats. Well, that can't happen bit by bit by bit. It just can't happen. So it's called irreducible complexity. But also you take a fish, Fred, and a fish lays, say, 3,000 eggs. And one of those eggs had a mutation when it formed, and it can survive just 0.1% better than any of the other 3,000 eggs, except for the fact that some other fish comes along and eats all those eggs, so that 99.9% of those eggs get destroyed before they're anything. And so you can't, that small advantage of survival can't overcome these other factors. It simply can't overcome them mathematically.
Yeah, not only that, natural selection can only work on pre-existing genes. It needs new information. That's a whole nother topic. So natural selection can't do anything but work on pre-existing genes. I wanted to read, we brought up about irreducible complexity. Here's a quote. If it could be demonstrated that any complex organ existed which could not possibly have been formed by numerous successive slight modifications, my theory would absolutely break down. Do you know who said that?
That sounds like Darwin.
That was Darwin.
Charles Darwin. So if there's anything that's irreducibly complex, then Darwinism is false. He admitted that. And, of course, that's when they thought cells were like ping pong balls. Now we know that cells are more complex than jet engines.
Oh, yeah, more complex than the whole city of Tokyo.
Than the city of Tokyo. And what's so interesting is in the book The Black Box, by Michael Behe.
Yeah, Darwin's Black Box.
Darwin's Black Box. He points out rotary protons, like the flagellum, is like an outboard motor. And an outboard motor can't be like half of the parts there and it works. And not only is it so wildly complex, but when you assemble it, it has to be assembled. All the parts have to come together in a certain order. They can't go together in a different order. And just ordering it in the right way, there's billions of ways that you can make these complicated proteins. And it would take trillions of years to go through all the ways by accident to come up with the right way to make this thing.
Well, that flagellum requires over 40 different proteins of function. And what's interesting, Bob, is you can take 8 million of these bacterial motors and they would fit in the cross section of a human hair.
Ooh.
And yet that all happened by chance and mistakes in the DNA. Right. You know, the Bible says in Romans 1 that men are without excuse when they deny God's clear, invisible attributes that he created the world.
Well, could we get now to Larry Witham's second book? He wrote this book, Where Darwin Meets the Bible, and he's this reporter for the Washington Times. 200 interviews of scientists, philosophers, theologians, writers. And then he wrote a book called By Design, Science and the Search for God, about the intelligent design movement. And I'd like to talk through some of that, Fred. And this book review is written by a Dr. Robert Latimer. And in here, he mentions the Cambrian explosion of life that we find in the fossil record, the Cambrian explosion. And it turns out, as Larry Witham documents in his book, that the Cambrian, now Darwinism, evolutionists say that life started from simple, like single-celled creatures, and that's an oxymoron, a simple single-celled creature.
Yeah, they love to use words like simple and ancestral. That's part of their illusion to sell it as evolution, but yet they're not very simple.
Is there
they?
A simple single-celled organism? I mean, life is so wildly complex, and it has to be. Biological life, by definition, is wildly complex.
Oh, yeah. And, Bob, I know that we're going to talk about your science pack that you offer. The Unlocking the Mysteries of Life shows really good graphical
DVD,
animation details of what we just talked about, the bacterial fledgling for the gel and motor, about the cell, the DNA, and how that works. And it's really done in a very easy way for people to understand.
Yeah. In fact, our science pack, we've been holding our annual telethon to raise $25,000. And, Fred, since this is Real Science Friday, people, if anyone would like to get our science pack, the BEL science pack, for $100, we will throw in a gift subscription to Creation Magazine, which is just the greatest glossy creationist magazine. But with our science pack, you get the DVD Unlocking the Mystery of Life and The Privileged Planet, which is fabulous. In the Beginning, a book by Dr. Walt Brown. And you get the Age of the Earth debate that I was involved in Denver, so much fun. And Genesis Creation, our Bible study album. So all that for $100 plus the Creation Magazine. Or if you give, just give. You might have all that already. Just give a gift to the telethon for $100 or more and ask for a gift subscription. It's our thank you to Creation Magazine. We'll give that to you. And you could do that by calling us at 1-800-8-NYART. 1-800-836-9278, or online. You could also give, you can order the science pack at kgov.com, kgov.com. Go to the store, either go to science or go to the specials department of our store at kgov.com, and that will help. Oh, and Fred, by the way, you're speaking tomorrow at a church.
I am, down in Highlands Ranch, and you can get details at youngearth.org, and it's at Holy Cross Church on Foothills Canyon Boulevard at 10 o'clock to 11:30 a.m., and I'm going to be talking about evidence for creation. And so this is both for adults and youth, so it's open to the public. In fact, they've been promoting it in the local newspaper. So it's free to the public, and if you want to hear more about this topic,
that'll
please stop by.
So great. And, Fred, I just love it when you talk about creation, evolution, science, because you've been studying this for many years. You're the webmaster for Creation Research Society, and there's so much for people to learn and be encouraged in their faith and how to share the gospel with others. And you begin with creation evolution. Millions of people are interested in that topic.
Yep, people love to talk about origins.
All right, so Larry Witham writes the second book about the intelligent design movement, and he discusses the Cambrian explosion, how if evolution were true, then life started with a simple single cell and gradually evolved to all these 32 orders of mammals and a million species and vertebrates and invertebrates and all these and all the flowering plants and trees. And that should be a gradual process over initially a billion years and then 100 million years and so on.
And we find exactly the opposite in the fossil record. I always say that God at every turn thwarts the naturalistic explanation. Mm. If we look at the fossil record, Bob, the Cambrian explosion is the sudden appearance of all major phyla, all major animal forms. How does evolution explain that? There's no trace of ancestors to this sudden appearance. Here's a quote from a book that I have that's written by evolutionists called The Rare Earth. Mm. For all the animal phyla to appear in one single short burst of diversification, education is not an obviously predictable outcome of evolution.
Right.
Evolution
exactly.
is so bad at predicting things. Yet a theory is supposed to make predictions.
Right.
Everything that evolution predicts fails.
Yeah, and in this book, Larry Witham writes that these different body plans, totally different kinds of creatures, seem to have burst out of nothing, and that the Cambrian does appear to be a genuine explosion demanding an explanation. So,
That's right. You find it,
the Cambrian explosion, it is an explosion. 32 orders of mammals all appearing instantly in the fossil record. What's with that?
And that's not the only problem. The other problem is it's like the emperor's new clothes. These things never change over the time in the fossil record. It's called stasis.
Yeah, so if they first appeared 100 million years ago or whatever, and like they find in amber, they find fossilized worms and fleas, insects, all kinds of bugs, and they even can look at their social pattern, because when the sap flows down a tree, it'll catch insects that were going about its business. And sometimes their business is some kind of a complex social pattern. So not only is the insect identical, but its behavior is identical for supposedly 100 million years.
That's right. Stephen Jay Gould, who's a leading evolutionist, said that it's an embarrassing feature of the fossil record that this no change over time is what they
witness. Change over time in the sudden explosion where the fossil record begins.
And he admits it's embarrassing. So he came up with a goofy theory called punctuated equilibrium, which basically says that life evolved in small populations isolated in the fossil, so that we never find evidence for it, basically.
Right,
so,
and very sudden, rapidly, the hopeful
monster
theory.
That's right, rapid, so exactly. That isolated populations evolved rapidly, so it didn't leave a trace in the fossil record. He gives a fossilification for his theory, finding gradual evidence of fossils in the fossil record, which is silly. That's no test on his theory. So his evidence for his theory is the fact that we don't find any evidence.
Right, yeah, right, which is circular reasoning. And, of course, that's what evolution is. But now let's go on to this book also discusses the anthropic principle that has burst onto the scene recently. And that's when we look at, like Albert Einstein said, that God does not play dice with the universe. Now, he didn't believe in God, a personal God. He believed in Spinoza's God, which was a reverence for nature. That was it, tragically. But Einstein saw that the laws of physics were explicable, like you could boil them down to nice, neat, clear mathematical equations. And why should that be? Why should it be that they're so explicable and that they're so practical that they help with life? So in the 70s, a number of scientists worked on this idea of the anthropic principle, which is that there are so many values of physical properties of the universe that are so finely tuned.
Yeah, finely tuned parameters. And that book I mentioned earlier, The Rare Earth, that mm-hmm. I pulled the fossil quote from, there were two evolutionists who wrote that book. And the whole point of that book is pretty much on this anthropic principle that there's so many rare things
about the Earth.
Basically, the Earth
and the moon.
There can't
and
be no
sun.
Other Earth in the whole universe because everything is so finely tuned here. We've got an ideal mass and color of the sun. The Earth is a precise distance from the sun. So is the moon. There's ideal carbon dioxide and oxygen nitrogen ratios. The charge and masses of fundamental particles have remarkably tight tolerances. Any small change renders life impossible. Mm. These are all quotes, Bob, not from a creationist, not from the CRSQ journal. I got these out of Rare Earth, a book written by evolutionists.
Right. If our sun was like other stars, our sun is so stable. It's the most stable. It is the most stable star ever discovered in that it puts out the steady amount of heat with just the slightest variation. You know how the global warming people go nuts over a degree difference? If our sun was like other stars and it would increase its heat output, its energy output by 6%, 5%, 12%, and go negative 12%, I mean, the Earth would be freezing over and boiling.
Oh, yeah, we'd global warming, but that'd be global heating.
Right, yeah. Yeah, it'd be like Mercury from this distance. And so we thank God for giving us such a stable sun to provide energy and light for us, and the moon, and how the moon keeps the oceans alive with its gravitational pull. And if the moon was further away or too close, we could have tidal waves covering the earth. Too far away, and the oceans would die.
Yeah, and you know, we're talking about how God thwarts a naturalistic explanation. There's the next article in the journal is about lichens. Mm. Now, Bob, you have a little bit of experience with lichens, don't you?
Oh, brother, lichens, yeah. Well, I was going across the country when I was a young teenager on a moped, no less, Fred. I got to Colorado Springs. I went up Pikes Peak. That was an experience. And I found a chunk of lichen on a rock, and I was a kid, you know, I'm a fool.
Yeah.
So I picked off a little chunk of it with my fingernail, and I put it on my tongue. I thought, I wonder what that, you know, I wonder if it has any taste. I don't even know what it is, lichen. It looks like a rock. And I got on my moped and went driving, and I passed out and fell right in the middle of the road in the street.
Oh, man.
And an ambulance took me to a hospital and took a couple days to recover. But I could have died from that lichen.
And I don't think it's – is it poisonous, Bob? I know some kinds are, no, some aren't. You must have grabbed the wrong
– No, well
– I would recommend not eating rocks, Bob. But,
no,
you know.
Right, yeah. Cattle in Wyoming – this is a story goes back 5 years – were dying in numbers. And the ranchers try to figure out why. And it turns out the cattle were licking lichen, and they were dying from that. So it is dangerous. I don't know which kinds – may or may not be poisonous.
Yep.
But lichen, there's a whole article in this book about lichen.
Lichen is a symbiotic relationship between algae and type of fungus. Mm-hmm. And so they really need each other to survive. And that's what this article gets into. How does evolution explain two organisms that need each other to survive?
Now, I've got Darwin another, mentioned that, right?
Yeah, I've got another quote from Darwin.
I bet you do.
This is what he said. If it could be proved that any part of the structure of any one species had been formed for the exclusive good of another species, it would annihilate my theory, for such could not have been produced through natural selection. Mm. Natural selection cannot produce this. I have a biology textbook that says almost Darwin's quote. It said, you know, with lichen, the algae and the fungus can't survive without each other.
Yeah, in fact, that's the beginning of this article here in this Creation Research Society Quarterly, is lichens are a life form composed of fungi growing in symbiotic union with algae. So lichens are a life form composed of fungus growing together with algae, and they need each other.
That's right. And, you know, there's all kinds of symbiotic relationships throughout nature. It's amazing the things that we could talk about, mm-hmm. and I know we're kind of getting low
we're
on time,
out of time.
Like the
could
clownfish
we...
and the anemone, Bob. You know, I've got a saltwater aquarium, and the anemone is this sponge-like thing that has tentacles, and it's, mm-hmm. the tentacles are poisonous. So if other fish touch it, it'll eat that fish. It'll numb the fish, paralyze it, then it's got a mouth, and it chows it down.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the clownfish lives in this anemone because it doesn't affect it. And the clownfish will go up and grab pieces of food that I put in the tank and go down and feed the anemone. It lives in there. That's a symbiotic relationship.
It's astounding, isn't it?
It is. But how
did Darwin said, if you find that'll disprove my theory.
And we find it all over nature.
All over nature. And some are not just two species.
Oh, yeah. The Brazilian nut tree requires it has a huge grapefruit-like pod that it drops on the ground. And we've got, and inside of it are nuts, but it takes forever it's real hard to get that thing open. It takes a human with a hammer and an anvil. Mm. But there's one creature in the world that has a long enough teeth to be able to crack that open to get those nuts out so that, you know, the tree can plant itself. Plus, the tree needs pollination from a type of bee, and that type of bee needs an orchid flower to survive.
It's just astounding, isn't it, how God created. Okay, we are out of time. Fred Williams, thank you. Let's do this again, all right?
Okay, sounds great, Bob.
More about the lichens. And Maranatha Christian Center, what a great school, Maranatha.